Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday edition, the 7th of January. It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. We welcome you to the program. A lot going on, and we will get to it momentarily. And be careful out there. It's icy and wet and dreary. And I'm saying this from experience, but I slipped a lot in the car. There's a lot of stuff on the road, so please be careful. You know, last night I was reading this huge, dense Norwegian melodrama of a book that I'm in, and it's like 1,100 pages. And it's great. It's really good. But my God, is it dense. And my God, is it depressing. And I usually love this. This is up my alley. This is my holiday present. And so I'm just ripping through this thing, and I'm just loving it. And there's just, there's one tragedy after another. And but there was a point where there's a very explicit scene involving a dead animal in which this person is photographing the animal. And I thought to myself, okay, I need a break. I just need a little bit of a break. So I put the book aside. And then I went and I started to get ready for the show and started doing stories. And about 15 minutes in, I was like, I wonder how that autopsy on the dead animal's going. And here we sit. Yes. So we have lots to talk about. We will get right to it. And let me introduce the group to you. We have a good one, as we always do. We're very lucky to have such wonderful people be a part of our program on a regular basis, and I appreciate them more than they will ever know. Bob Griffin is here, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. It's apropos. Today is the I'm not going to take it today day, which I think is it may be the theme of today.
Little twisted sister, we're not going to take it anymore.
Yes. I also came up with an important decision over break that I'm going to self-identify as an oil company from now on, so that I can ensure that I get tax benefits and money from the government and protection from our law enforcement and military. So please refer to me as Oil Corporation as my pronoun.
We will.
Thank you.
Thanks for it.
Yes. Associate Professor of Government of Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council in the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel joins us. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
How are you?
Glad to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program, as always. And Mike Spain joins us, former Times Union Associate Editor. Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm good. I'm happy to see it's warming up today, which should make it a little easier to get home than it was for a lot of people to get to work today.
That's right. And we will obviously have forecasts throughout the day and keep you informed as to what's going on, as we always do here at WAMC, which is the perfect time for me to remind you that it's lockbox time. And it's that time of the year where we have a fun drive coming up in about 3.5 weeks. And this is the time where we ask you to think and say everything that you give now is less that we have to make during the actual drive. Well, you know, we've been saying this for quite a while, and we say it. And I just want to point to our last fund drive, which was in the fall of last year. And it perfectly illustrated what we're talking about, because people really did. They gave and they gave and they gave and they gave beforehand. And what would normally, in some cases, take us 6, 7, 8 days took us 2.5. So that's the point. And we could do that even now, where we don't even have to start. Here's the thing. Why do we do that? It's not for bragging rights. It's not to thump our chest and say, "Oh, we did this in a great period, a very short period of time." No, it's because we really, there's a lot of stuff going on. We want to continue to do what it is that we do. And in fact, we're working and we're tweaking a bit to make sure that we stay on longer so that you get the news that you need, because it's the time where we really have to know what's going on. We're in one of those stages, to me anyway, we're in one of those stages, like, if and Bob and I were just talking about this, but like, if not us, who? Like, who else is covering this stuff? And some of the quote-unquote legacy media even is having trouble getting the truth out. So that leaves us and others, and so whatever support you can give us now is greatly appreciated. We'll ramp this up slowly as we go through January and get ready for our February 2nd fund drive officially. But in the meantime, whatever you can do to get the ball rolling, that would be great. Already the money is coming in, and we appreciate it, and we thank you so much. If you are a member and you would like to raise your what you give as a sustaining member, I've heard that a lot. I was walking in the front office yesterday and heard that in a couple cases of people calling up and were upping the amounts. If you haven't made a pledge in a while, now's a great time. And if you've never given, certainly we would love to welcome you to our family. We're a fun group. And so I think whatever you can do would be much appreciated. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. If you must call us, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. And if you enjoy this program, if you enjoy what we do, if you are someone who relies on it, then we ask you to think about supporting it so that we can continue to do what we do in the manner that we do it. We thank you very, very much. All right, let's get on with the show and what's going on. The breaking news this morning is that the U.S. has seized a Russian-flagged tanker that fled the Venezuela blockade. The and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but it's the tanker. It's Marinera.
Sounds like Marinera.
Yeah, it is. I think it's Marinera, but Marine Era. I don't know. I think it's Marinera.
I think Marine Era may be what we're talking about.
A Marine Era. That's right. Had been pursued by the U.S. Coast Guard for weeks, and now has been seized. It has been, I'm sorry, the U.S. officials tell the Washington Post it has not been seized. It has been secured. U.S. federal law enforcement personnel are currently on board. The officials said the mission went off without any interference from Russian vessels. In a statement, U.S. European Command said the vessel was seized in the North Atlantic pursuant to a warrant issued by a U.S. federal court for alleged sanctions violations. The Coast Guard had the lead for the operation with U.S. military support, officials said. The tanker has been pursued by the Coast Guard for weeks after the ship, originally named the Bella One, evaded a naval blockade near Venezuela. In the time since, it sailed back across the Atlantic and reflagged itself a Russian-owned vessel. Its seizure is likely to raise tensions between Washington and Moscow. The Marinera was last tracked in the North Atlantic Ocean headed toward Iceland. The seizure operation was reported earlier by Reuters, and I am reading from a report from the Washington Post.
Can I start with a snarky comment?
Of course.
The Coast Guard needs faster boats. It took them a week to catch a fully loaded tanker. I mean, their boats aren't faster than that? Are you kidding me?
I mean, I don't. Yes, snarky, but I think
it's like the O.J. Simpson's chase scene all over again, aquatic style.
Marinara style.
Marinara style.
It's in the sauce.
Yes. Really? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I feel that sometimes when we're trying to get from one place to the other, and they say, "Oh, we're on day three," and I'm like, "Really? Does it take that long?"
Right. Yeah.
Well, anyway. So, what does this do for us? What do we think about this particular action?
It's interesting to me, just to clarify, that the New York Times uses the term the U.S. military intercepted.
Intercepted, secured,
yeah, I mean,
or
they're
seized.
Using all these euphemisms for captured, I guess. The military took over. I mean, they're trying to downplay this as a military operation when, in fact, it is, and portray it as a police app, police operation, you know, just patrolling the seas. And we should see it for what it is. It's a military operation.
The thing that concerns me, and I think concerns all of us, is the fact that the words, the move deepens a confrontation with Russia. And what does that mean?
With Russia, and this particular move with Russia, of course, and in general, our actions in Venezuela with China, which has invested tremendous amounts in Venezuela, and of course isn't going to just quietly let go of its investment. But in the long run, I think it's clear that the two adversaries of the United States, China and Russia, are benefiting from our actions in Venezuela. While currently the discussions are about allies, China's and Russia's allies, and the interest in oil, in the long run, China benefits from our policy of wanting to secure the Western Hemisphere, leaving Asia to China and leaving Europe to Russia. And that is where my concern is.
I mean, this would be a story, Bob, at any time, but the fact that it's happening within days of what happened in Venezuela and the renewed concerns of what is going to happen in other places, such as Greenland, Cuba, Panama, Colombia, ..
Yeah, there's a couple points I'd like to add to the conversation. One, I do note, though, besides a snarky comment about the speed of the Coast Guard boats, the fact that they identified the Coast Guard element, because the Coast Guard has this weird sort of quasi-military, quasi-law enforcement capacity. In fact, the law enforcement element is in the Coast Guard. It's not in the Navy. That's the way the military is supposed to be prohibited from doing law enforcement. So I found it interesting that it was identified as a Coast Guard element. I also am concerned with the rising tension with Russia. We'd be blind to the fact that we have completely isolated ourselves from our allies. Mm-hmm. And at the same time that we have poked at China, poked at Russia, we have made enough noise about Greenland that people are now talking about the very real potential for a disillusionment of NATO.
Mm-hmm.
So who haven't we pissed off, Joe? And it's almost like the policies of this administration are perfectly designed to isolate the United States on the global stage, to the point where I think that is the biggest threat to our national safety and security. I also have zero faith in Stephen Miller. I have zero faith in Donald Trump. I also would be very concerned if I was in the Ukraine, because he will sell out the Ukraine in order to pacify Putin. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if there is a push to create some sort of fake deal. That's a trade-off between, you know, we take Venezuela, you take Ukraine, you take
Taiwan. China.
Yeah, we'll take. This game that's now being played by this country, it feels more like a bad game of Risk, the board game, than it does of real national policy,
and not thought out.
It's not cohesive. You can't tell me. I still don't understand why we're in Venezuela. I'm sorry, I don't. You can't go from pardoning a convicted drug dealer who is the head of his country in Honduras to the type of action that we saw in Venezuela. sorry, you can't do it. And yeah, I get that he was all
a
of
bad
the bad
guy.
A bad guy. Hmm. But if we went into every country and took out bad guys, I mean,
we'd be busy.
Well, I mean, then other people should be coming in and taking care of the same problem that we have here. I mean, it's a complete breakdown of the world order.
You mentioned Trump. You mentioned Stephen Miller, Marco Rubio.
Well, he's a spineless wannabe baby who's a parasite on the back of this administration who's now just along for the ride and can't get off. I mean, I think the same thing about J.D. Vance. Rubio's a complete sellout.
And I only bring it up because at the beginning of this, well, of last year, he was to be the adult of the room.
No, he's an opportunist. I think you laid it out very well, like the impact this has had on our standing in the world and our credibility on our true strengths that came from soft power and our allies. Within a year, we've lost it all, and we've lost it as a result of intentional actions of this administration. It's extraordinary. But it's like talking about Greenland and the impact it has on our allies. I'm looking at the European countries very closely and how they're trying to find a balance in protecting NATO as an absolute necessary institution for European security, but also the U.S. security. It's the seeing how NATO is being dismantled in front of our eyes, an institution that has kept the European countries, but also the United States, safe for decades is mind blowing to me for sure. But it's at the same time they're trying to balance their relationship with the United States that is seriously thinking about using military power to invade a NATO member, like having to keep them on board to secure Europe at large by keeping the United States involved in Ukraine. It is an extraordinary balancing act that they're dealing with. And it is, again, extraordinary to think that we're at a place like this.
I want to take a break and we'll be back and continue the conversation. I'm really struck by the word you used of this intentional actions, mm-hmm. which I think is really important to consider in this. We'll be right back after this break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning, the 7th of January, 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. Bob Griffin, Karen Riedel, and Mike Spain with us this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We started off with the story about the U.S. intercepting a Russian-flagged tanker that fled the Venezuela blockade. That led us into many other directions, of course, as it naturally would, regarding what else is happening in the world. And this all comes on the heels of Saturday's action in Venezuela, with Maduro being taken, President Maduro being taken from that country and brought to the United States, had a court appearance earlier this week, and the fallout from that still continuing, especially in Venezuela, yeah. where they are working on sort of what now, the question that we often have been asking on this program over the last few days is, so what happens now? And we still really haven't come to any understanding of that?
Well, I mean, we do understand that the same regime is in place. Maduro and his wife are out, but the same regime is there. And there was a Washington Post article yesterday that let us know that 14 journalists have been detained in the last few mm-hmm. days. Armed gangs were sent to the capital, restricted protesters, arrested citizens who appeared to be involved in promoting or supporting the armed attack by the United States of America. Nothing's really going to change in Venezuela. If anything, we are stirring up internal violence. And so It has to be fair. I mean, it's very clear, I'm sure, to all of our listeners, this was about oil and oil only. This has nothing to do with democracy or democracy building, strengthening institutions from inside that would help the citizens to rebuild a democratic system. And I'm so saddened for the Venezuelan diaspora and Venezuelans at home who are hopeful, because I personally have no hope that the actions, the U.S. actions in Venezuela, will actually stabilize the country.
I'm going to disagree on one thing you said, and I don't think it's just about oil. I think this is as much about Epstein and the economy and his surrounding himself with insecure men, children, like Pete Hegseth. I think that this is viewed as a way of getting the rah-rah, hyper-patriotic, go military, we're going to be men and nobody's going to tell us what we're going to do crowd back on his side. There's another villain in this story, too, that I want to toss out, and that's Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, I'll put a call out right now that any member of Congress that doesn't come out against this does not deserve a seat. I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you don't deserve a seat. And if there's an institution that has failed more than any other, it's the congressional checks and balances. And it starts with the House, but it certainly doesn't forgive the Senate for their sins. And we can't lose sight of that. And it's interesting to see that Trump is sort of realizing that, and coming out and talking about the midterms. But Congress could put its foot down, and then they could begin the legal process of replacing parts of the administration that are not following the law.
So I agree with you 100%. We've been having this conversation for 10 years.
We have. And it's coming, and it's festering, and it's rotten, and it's about to burst, Joe. It's about to burst. I think it's much worse today than it was 10 years ago. We have a speaker in place who is criminal. In his failure to perform the oath of office, I mean, to the point where I think he should be charged for his lack of fiduciary responsibility. But again, anybody who's listening, there's a warning shot out there to anybody who's in office right now. If you want to remain in office, we better start hearing from you.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that, and I don't want to bring the conversation off into a completely different direction, but the instinct of congressional members has been, well, if we say anything, we're going to be primaried and then we're going to be out of a job.
Yeah.
And now they're just looking for the exits. I mean, scattering like roaches when the light goes on.
Let me help you show. I can help show you where the exits are. I mean, go now, though. Okay. Because
yes.
If you're not going to do your job, then get out.
Yeah. One thing you said I'd like to go back to, Bob, and that is, in the midst of all the confusion, the 3 days in a row where, they go into Venezuela, United States troops, they capture Maduro and his wife, they bring him to Brooklyn, and in that time, President Trump says that we are going to run Venezuela, we are going, Marco Rubio is going to lead Venezuela, and then the Sunday morning talk shows where Rubio tries to talk that back and clarify it. It's very, very, very clear that they have no plan. And I don't think it's any kind of coincidence that during this same weekend, you get Stephen Miller and his wife posting images of Greenland with stars and stripes blazoned across it. You get Miller talking about,
that's the job of a Supreme Court justice's wife, for
right,
God's sakes.
That's right. thank you, Ms. Alito. Anyway, it what it It is exactly what you say. It's like, as we're confused and our heads are spinning by the complete, you know, just chaos caused by our taking of Maduro and his wife and killing, what, 80 people, 75, 80 people in Venezuela. And I mean, if it's a police action, I mean, if there was a drug dealer held up in, you know, like some, you know, rural area in the United States and the FBI went in and killed 75 people to get them, I mean, it's not worth it. You know what I mean? You if you value human life and you value ethics and morality, that is not a reasonable way to do it. Political pressure, as Karen was saying, you know, long planning the next several steps and trying to work your way there. That is the way to deal with situations like Venezuela. Have a long-term plan and then implement that with discipline and flexibility. But what's going on now is we're getting serious talk about Greenland in the midst of all this. And it is a distraction. And even Venezuela now is a distraction to the economy. It's a distraction to the fact that health care benefits for millions of Americans. The subsidies for the Affordable Care Act have ceased on January 1st. It's a distraction, you know, for Epstein. And maybe the Epstein files, you know, millions more documents need to come out. Maybe they are going to have something, although I think that's just sort of a drip, drip, drip. I don't know that that's going to – who knows what that's going to show. But everything is a distraction from the previous thing. Every day starts anew, saying, how do we get past that? Let's start something new. And I always thought that – I mean, always. I was hopeful that the talk about taking over Greenland would kind of dissipate the way the talk about making Canada our 51st state. They haven't said that in about a week or so. You know, I thought that it would back off, but now I wonder.
Again, with Greenland, the focus isn't security. The focus, again, is
resources.
Resources, yeah. Earth, yeah. Minerals, et cetera, et cetera. And they want it. And then, again, this is a great timing for the United States because Europe is in a difficult spot. Only six European nations signed the memorandum backed the Danish and Greenlandish rights.
But they're all our allies. It was our allies that backed.
Yes, but there should have been many, Denmark. Many more European countries that should have signed on to this. Yeah. And so it just shows the real difficult spot European countries are in right now. But yes, and Bob, to go back to your point, I absolutely agree. This isn't just about oil. We don't need Venezuela's oil. It is about a very strong sentiment in this administration that our power comes from our military. And that is so extraordinarily misguided.
I have always felt that the power of the country was the ideals that, as imperfect as we were, I felt like we were trying to accomplish the idea of equality and opportunity, and freedom of thought and association, all of which is being cast aside, I just think about where we are, and I shudder to think that, you know, we traded what I think was a fundamentally good experiment for cheaper groceries that hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. I also fully expect that the chaos needs to continue, Joe, because there has to be an enemy in order for the midterms to potentially shift. You have to be able to say, ignore things like the pedophiles in power. You have to be able to say, don't worry about the economy because it's your sacrifice because we're at war. And if you change the administration, then you know, our military is going to die. So you're more likely than not going to see that the chaos actually is a mechanism of trying to regain the elected control, even though he and his administration have shown no compulsion to follow the law.
We'll take a break. When we come back, I want to focus in on Greenland and talk about that story and that that issue in a little more detail. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. I know the show is 2 hours long, but like in 3 minutes, we just solved pretty much every problem in the world.
Well, I think we identified. I'm not sure we solved them.
No, you had some pretty good thoughts there. I think we did pretty good. Well, we welcome your thoughts as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I was struck by two separate headlines last night as I was putting stories together for this morning's broadcast. And the one was I want to get my news sources correct. One in the New York Times about Marco Rubio telling lawmakers that Trump wants to buy Greenland. And as that was published digitally on the website of the New York Times, the Washington Post came out and talked about this military plan that they have for taking over Greenland and looking at that, and obviously how the Danish and NATO officials and others are
and people of Greenland
and people of Greenland, of course, who are extremely upset about that. So what direction are we going in here? And I think it is interesting to look at it. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has told lawmakers that President Trump plans to buy Greenland rather than invade it, while Mr. Trump has asked aides to give him an updated plan for acquiring the territory. Mr. Rubio made his remarks in a briefing on Monday with lawmakers from the main armed services and foreign policy committees in both chambers of Congress, the same day Mr. Trump told aides to deliver an updated plan. The congressional briefing was focused on Venezuela, but lawmakers raised concerns about Mr. Trump's intentions on Greenland, given aggressive remarks this week by the American president and his top aide, Stephen Miller. Mr. Rubio did not go into detail on what he meant by buying Greenland.
From whom?
I don't know. So do you have to roll the dice and get the exact number to be able to purchase it from the bank?
Well, no, but I mean, from whom? Who do you pay the money to? Who owns it? Because Denmark just sort of helps run it. They don't really...
Well, it's the people of Greenland, right?
Isn't so you buy it from each one of them? No, I just wonder what the process would be.
It's a lot of checks.
Well, and it's a guy that doesn't pay his bills anyway, so why would anybody trust that?
Mr. Rubio did not go into detail, but Mr. Trump spent decades in New York as a real estate developer, and one of his top diplomatic envoys, Steve Witkoff, comes from the same background. Mr. Trump has coveted...
Steve Witless.
Mr. Trump has snarky comment number two from Mr. Griffin. Trump has coveted Greenland since his first term. I think that word coveted is so well used here because that does seem to be the case.
Can I just mention, Vice President Vance and his wife went to Greenland. They were going to go to some event there, some winter Iditarod type thing, and then it was it disclosed that wouldn't be welcome. So they ended up going to a U.S. military base there. The U.S. has military operations already in Greenland and have since the Cold War. They've cut back at them since the Cold War back down. But under some kind of Cold War treaty, goes back to the 50s, the U.S. can simply go in there and set up base if it needs to protect the United States. And I don't even think Greenland would object to that. I mean, why do you have to own it to do that? Greenland's not going to, if the United States decided to set up another military base or enhance the base it has there or bring some tankers up the coast, Greenland has no army that they're going to object. They probably would like the revenue it might bring, and they can maintain their own independence and their own sovereignty. it's not strategically necessary to defend the United States to own Greenland. We can do anything militarily that we need to there.
It's also not necessary to own Greenland to get the benefits of the minerals that are there. It's
we
like
can
that's
negotiate
what
that.
Global trade is all
yeah.
about, right? It's like
exactly.
Should be cheaper to just trade it rather than buy Greenland.
I'm so glad you mentioned the visit to Greenland by Vice President J.D. Vance, which happened on March 28th of last year. And I bring this up, and snarky and petty, and I apologize, but...
But
it gave the opportunity for the Washington Post to again publish the Reuters photo that was taken of J.D. Vance in Greenland. And listeners, if you get a chance, just look it up, because to me, this is akin to the Mike Dukakis in the helmet in the tank photo. He's in a puffer jacket. It's sort of ill-fitting, and he's just out in the cold.
You know what he's saying, though, Joe? The plane.
It's the oddest picture.
It was an Arctic version of Tattoo.
It was odd in March, and it continues to be odd. But meanwhile,
but Joe, can we stick with this for just one
of course.
Second? Where has the vice president been?
Well, that's an interesting question of regarding Venezuela.
Regarding anything, I mean.
Well, what I found interesting was that he seems to be very removed from Venezuela. Although when the president was asked during the gaggle on Air Force One on Sunday night, as he was returning from Mar-a-Lago to the White House,
the
under construction White House, he said, "Well, who is in charge?" Who's in charge? And he said, "Well, you know, Rubio, and me, and JD will be in there too." And
when you care enough to send the very best.
but that struck me because that seemed to be intentional, as much as anything is intentional here, that. Because there had been those question marks about what J.D. Vance was his involvement in this military action.
Do you think Mike Pence is sitting at home right now going, "Thank God"?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think he usually
says that anyway.
Right? Regular conversations with the God anyway, but yes. Danish officials are increasingly alarmed that the Trump administration has shifted toward an active effort in recent days to seize Greenland. This from the Washington Post. Now, remember, an autonomous territory of Denmark. They say utilizing the U.S. military is always an option to acquire the Arctic island. That came from Carolyn Leavitt last night. In trying to explain what the intentions were. The declaration that President Trump could use force to take Greenland came hours after a sharp warning on Tuesday from European leaders that Washington needed to respect the borders of a longtime ally. This gets into what we were discussing earlier about our allies and what we have done to those relationships over a relatively short period of time. U.S. officials in recent days have presented a U.S. move against Greenland as an increasingly concrete possibility in conversations with European counterparts, said a senior European diplomat who, like others, spoke on the condition of anonymity. Those conditions and conversations have transformed an ongoing and more conventional discussion among U.S., Danish, and Greenlandic leaders about increased U.S. military and economic investments in the territory into something more fraught, according to the diplomat. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told lawmakers on a closed-door briefing late Monday that the escalation in public rhetoric was part of a broader strategy to pressure Denmark into selling Greenland to the United States rather than capture it by military force. For those of you keeping track, Marco Rubio seems to be using the term coerce a lot
lately about we're not going to take action as much as we're going to coerce. And that was one of the things he said on Sunday in Venezuela, that we weren't going to run the country. We were just going to coerce them into doing what we wanted them to do. And that was similar to what he is saying here in regards to Greenland and us apparently taking it over. But the White House on Tuesday made clear that force still very much a possibility. I know a separate conversation for another day, but the sending Rubio out, having him make a declaration, and then
pulling the rug out from under him.
Pulling the rug out is, to me, will never get old.
Oh, God. What does using force to take over Greenland look like?
I don't know.
Sending a ship up and raising a flag somewhere? I mean, it's not.
You know, but we're making light of it. But there is, I really have concerns. Obviously, many concerns. But it's also, the reputation of our military, and how I view the military, and honestly, how I view law enforcement. And unfortunately, I think that pertains to all levels of law enforcement right now. I am so suspect of government and the government agencies right now. This is going to have a long term effect. And I look at what the military is doing, and I see them as more complacent in the destruction of the country rather in defense of it. And this is going to be a real problem. The other question, you know, and people say, well, what can we do? I mean, besides voting and registering to voting and getting involved, I mean, at some point in time, there has to be enough outrage that we start basically shutting down. You know, there's days where you don't go to work. You have to start to send a message that the people actually have the power. And it's not the oligarchs, and it's not the military. And every one of these elements of chaos, I think, is pushing us more towards that sort of internal strife.
Well,
and final thought, Joe.
Yes.
You know, we're putting people with no insurance. You know, health insurance is unaffordable. You can't afford groceries. But we have enough money to do all this other stuff. We have enough money to go buy Greenland if we don't have enough money to provide basic care for our own people. How is this America first?
Right. And I mean, you said something very important a moment ago. You said many important things, but one of them being, you know, we make light of this. It's so hard almost not to, because, like, just when what you just said, like, how do we have the money to buy Greenland, which leads you to what Mike was saying, like, what was it cost? Like, what's that price tag? And who's setting that? And much like you brought up, Mike, about, you know, how do you take military Greenland by military force? Those are questions that are just really hard to answer.
They're absurd questions.
They are absurd questions. But obviously with very real concern and consequences attached to them. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. First, a break and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, joins us this morning, as does Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel. And Mike Spain is here, former Times Union Associate Editor. We welcome your comments, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And thank you, as always. Want to get to some letters. We're talking about a lot of things, and want to get to a few letters here before we move on. Christine says, by alienating our allies, we are making China, with its 2 billion people, stronger and America weaker. the EU could start sanctioning us with Canada against our actions to take over other countries. We are weakening our bargaining in trade with other countries. That from Christine.
And we've given up our mantle of moral leadership as well, which I think is even more difficult to
get back.
I don't think we'll ever get it back. Why would you ally with us? I look at all of these actions. I look at the bullying. I look at his press conferences. I look at Stephen Miller and I think, why would anybody want to ally with us?
Beth writes, why doesn't the world simply pull back on buying U.S. treasuries and point out how dependent we are on them? That is in a note titled Global Schooling. David writes, one needs to only cast back to Trump's first administration where Fiona Hill, on record, spoke about the quote-unquote deal Putin approved, wherein he would let the U.S. have its way with Venezuela if we let Putin have his way in Ukraine. And I'll reiterate a comment from yesterday's show. It's Venezuela gold and coast that the U.S. really is after, the largest gold assets in the world. That from David. Russ says the theory that seizing Venezuelan oil exports will coerce the regime into compliance is unfortunately flawed. With limited income, the security services of Venezuela will resort to ever more brutal behavior, especially as refugees are repatriated from the U.S. with American cash in their possession.
That's a really important point that I was going to comment on. I forget what my thought was going to be, so I apologize for.
But don't you think that with Maduro out, it gives our immigration officials the rationale, quote unquote, around the word rationale, to send any Venezuelans who are here seeking asylum and here on temporary visas back and say, it's okay, now you can go back, and putting them on one of the new ICE planes that they're buying and sending them back.
See, and that's not going to, I'm going to tell you why I don't think that's going to happen. Because right now, Trump is the darling of those folks
who were voting.
And if you look what's going on in Florida, it's now become too important a voting block, and it's all about partisan politics. So I actually don't believe that's going to happen.
I hope it doesn't.
Yeah. We go to a letter from Kay.
But before you go on, Joe, yes, one other comment, though. I mean, we're back to the failed U.S. policy of military intervention with no idea what we're going to do if we succeed. And I want to draw a correlation to something that's always bugged me, that I thought Biden mishandled the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But at the same time, what gets lost in the story is the way it was forced on the administration by Trump's policies. If you think about what he did in Afghanistan, what he set in place that then Biden was implementing, that failure was a failure of overall U.S. policy, and certainly in Afghanistan and in Iraq, our inability to, we're really successful at winning wars. We are complete failures at winning peace. And I think that Venezuela is just another example, because the only thing I've seen since the takeover or since the capture and the military action down there is all of the bones of another failed state down there. I mean, there seems to be chaos and more repression in Venezuela, not less. So we've just made a bad situation even worse.
Without putting you on the spot, Mike, and I certainly don't ask this question to have you, first of all, I don't know if you agree with me, but second of all, speak on behalf of all journalists, but it does seem, and I guess this gets to what we were talking about before, the
there was the action that took place on Saturday. The president spoke Saturday morning. The court appearance was on Monday. And I had a hard time finding a story about it yesterday in the paper.
Online?
Yeah. Online, yes. Yeah. And even on in the broadcast media. Yeah.
It quickly fell into place as just another story, another thing going on. It wasn't, it was certainly the lead story on Sunday morning.
It
was
absolutely
big news. It was everywhere. It was the front page of every newspaper, et cetera. I mean, the timing made that possible. But it seemed to be routine almost by Monday when Maduro was helicoptered over from Brooklyn to Manhattan to face the federal the wrath of the federal court system. Mm. Yeah. Just a sidebar there. Pam Bondi, the attorney general, says that anybody who doesn't comply will face the wrath of the Justice Department. The wrath of the Justice Department. The Justice Department is supposed to be about justice, which is what is right, and it's supposed to be a fair and balanced system of the judiciary that allows both sides to make their case, that a jury and a judge presides to make sure it's fair. It's not wrath. It has to be implementing the law. And when you throw wrath into that, it completely turns it upside down. It is not an instrument of wrath. It's an instrument of justice, or at least that's what the Founding Fathers intended it to be. Sidebar off that. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, every single big story gets diminished quickly because there's another big story. And yesterday it seemed to be the economy again. It was economic issues were like the lead stories.
Right, and Greenland.
Yeah, and Greenland, of course. And the fact that the media, I mean, you've heard the criticism that the media goes after the shiny objects and Trump knows how to put up shiny objects. I think it's true. I think we even you know, almost a decade into Donald Trump's political aspirations, the shiny objects thing continues to be there. And other politicians have done that, too. The media has a very short attention span, I think, because the American public has a very short attention span. We were saying during the break that many students you guys are both academics, and you're exposed every day to young people. They don't read the long story that might be in the Atlantic. They don't read the online version of the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever legitimate news agency. They'll look for the headlines. They'll skim the headlines that get sent to them or purpose to them on social media. They don't have the depth. And it's because so much is going on and chaos, planned chaos, is working. It keeps us from focusing on, I mean, this Venezuelan story is huge. I mean, it's the equivalent of what Putin is doing to Ukraine in many ways. It's going in there for natural resources. And
I also realize, and I want to get to Bob, but I also realize that it is a story that is slow moving. I mean, we're going to see.
His next appearance is in March 17th.
That's right.
So what happens during now and March 17th?
And we keep asking this question of what happens next, what happens next. And that's going to take a while to develop within the country of Venezuela of what happens next. And as far as leadership and our action in that and ..
I'm happy to see that many of the networks have people on the ground in Venezuela, and the big news agencies do too, and the Associated Press, and they are going to be reporting. You know, I'm looking for the stories on the funerals of the 80 so people that were killed by U.S. forces and bombing in the process to arrest a drug dealer. I'm looking for stories about the chaos. And I've seen some of them, you know, people lining up to get groceries, lining up to get gasoline, people worried about how they're going to feed their families, the economy, which was already in shambles, now being sort of frozen in shambles. I hope that that story gets told, and I hope that people pay attention to it. But we have a short attention span. And the Super Bowl is coming up, Joe. People are going to be watching that.
But of course, I mean, we do Bells. Need deeper analysis because
it's there though. It is there. Don't you think, Karen? If you want to find a good, thorough analysis of what's going on, if you look and you know where to look, you can find several, and you'll learn. But you have to be dedicated to wanting to know that, and I'm afraid that's not where most people are at.
I want to hear your response to that. I just quickly want to say though, I think we have this trouble on this show too. There's so much. There's just so much. So if you want to do a deep dive into one aspect or one story, there's going to be four or five that you have to push off to the side. So I understand the issues in the media, and not only for that give and take of the real estate, but also, as you mentioned, rightfully so, of our attention span. If we take a deep dive here, how much energy do we have to then go into the next crisis to read the 14-page in-depth article on that and then go back to that really depressing Nordic book that I'm reading?
Right. Just to lift your spirits.
Yes. Karen.
Yeah, I think there's so much to be said about this, right? But it's like, yeah, I did notice too yesterday, I heard quite a bit about the judge, Judge Hellerstein, who's supposedly a wonderful
92 years old.
Very competent judge and has tried numerous very controversial issues in his rulings, and his engagement has been admirable. But he is 92, and there was a very insightful article in the New York Times that explained, look, it's hard to be a judge at 92.
Was that the Tubin piece? The Jeffrey Tubin piece?
Yes.
Piece. Jeffrey Tubin did a piece yesterday about, you know, mm-hmm. it's fun's fun, but this is something that really we have to.
But what I think what we need to, what the media needs to convey again is that it's not about Maduro being an anarcho-terrorist, right? It's like we're not in Venezuela. We did not take him out because he's an anarcho-terrorist. We were there for other reasons.
Right.
And so that's what concerns me. So the focus now, when we look at the trial, and I mean, there wasn't much to report on yesterday, right? Other than the fact that the judge is 92 years and that might be problematic. But to draw the connection, actually, the analysis is like, why is he here? Why are we doing this, right? I mean, that was certainly missing. And again, during the break, we talked briefly about students. And every time I come to class, I ask my students, what did you hear about yesterday? Right? I say, well, what's been in the news? And they do hear things, and they hear things that I have never heard about. But they certainly do not hear the stories that are the headlines of my news sources. And that is not just the case for young people. This is the case also across the board of the political spectrum. And I think it's so important to remember that so many of our peers throughout the country do not get the same, not just the same analysis, not just the same framing, but they hear entirely different news and they have entirely different priorities that are presented to them.
Yeah, and at a global, not at a global level, but certainly at a national level, my feeling is that the country's still asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And the college campuses, which were once hotbeds of thought and outrage, have been silenced. I think the administrations have been cowed. I think about how successful the administration was in clipping the voices of academia when they brought in the presidents of Penn and Harvard and sort of forced resignations.
Columbia
yeah. Forced resignations there. How they have created greater dependency on campuses to fight for funding in research, sometimes I think at the expense of the core moral values of the institutions. This is all part of a bigger plan, Joe. And you know, we've said it before. Go back and read Project 2025. Mm-hmm. The problem with Project 2025 is that I actually think it succeeded way beyond what the Heritage Foundation thought it could, and they have unleashed a hell on this country that they were not prepared for, but they should be held accountable for.
It was surprising, given that it was so cast aside during the campaign as don't look at this. Don't. This is not what we're up to.
No
this
idea
is
what
it.
You're talking
we
about.
We have no idea what you're talking about. Yeah. I've never read it. I've never even heard the phrase that it has been.
The
so,
playbook.
Right. It has been the playbook and has been so successfully implemented in such a short period of time.
Yep. And we brought Musk in and his crew of misfits in. They destroyed the administration. So even the idea of any type of enforcement right now is going to have to be rebuilt. And again, Congress sat aside. And we have, I think, again, an illegitimate Supreme Court that has enabled the behavior to the point where Trump knows that he has a get out of jail free card, which allows him to basically ignore both the law and think about in the case of the Epstein file, and certainly his administration is taking full advantage of that.
Back to the letters, we go to Kay, who writes, democracy is not a spectator sport. The distractor-in-chief is surrounded by like minds. Start paying closer attention to the numbers and ignore the hyperbole from a math-challenged administration preaching to its choir. There are more guns in this country than the total population, and a majority of those weapons are in the possession of the solid minority who support Donald J. Trump. The divider-in-chief is intentionally pushing our system to a breaking point because he intends for his oligarchs and their minions to be in control when the chaos they cause is over by militant means. The Don is already musing openly of preventing the midterm elections because he expects to be impeached again.
Yeah.
Yes. He's also signaling his base to lock and load. That from Kay, who probably gave us the most sobering letter of the morning.
She was out reading a Norwegian novel.
Yes. By the way, I want to say we've gotten like five or six letters.
You're not going to talk about
very
it.
People very mad at me for not giving the title of the book. And
I'm one of them, by the way.
Yeah. Well, the reason I didn't was because I'm not. It's big, and I haven't finished it yet. And if it sucks, I don't want it to seem like I was endorsing it. But anyway, the name of the book, it comes out next week. I don't think it doesn't say like so far. It's amazing. But it's Carl of Nausgaard, who has been out there for a while. And the name of the book is The School of Night. And the book will be released next Tuesday. And we'll be a guest on an upcoming book show. But Carl of Nausgaard, and the book is The School of Night. It's really good. Okay. So far. That's right. Okay. So I want to make that point. All right. Let's go to Doug, who says, what happens if Maduro is acquitted in his trial? I don't see much evidence that he and or his wife are guilty of narco-terrorism. If the U.S. loses its case, how does that affect the nation's already tumbling standing in the world, the administration's tenuous credibility, Venezuela, and Maduro itself? I know it's a big what-if question, but I think it's one worth asking.
I think it's a great question. You know, when I read Pam Bondi's statement, that, and I think she also included the fact that he owned machine guns. I mean, the stuff that they threw into the statement was so bizarre.
Aren't you happy that there's gun control going on, though? Isn't that something good?
Well, and since when do we control gun ownership in other countries? I mean, unless they were owning machine guns here, which I don't think they were. But I mean, this, you know, I still think this is a place for the international courts,
right?
Which we don't acknowledge or
no
accept. Yeah.
Well, and we certainly aren't going to now, because you know we've violated enough of the statutes where the most of the administration couldn't travel internationally without being concerned about getting picked up.
I may be all wet on this, but it does seem that given the administration's criticism against the administration for their handling of other legal cases and them being very slipshod and not doing their homework and being being quite infantile in the way that they were that they were presented, that as this was emerging, this narrative that came out of, we've been working on this for a 10-year indictment of putting it together very carefully over this incredibly long period of time, crossing every I, dotting every I, crossing every T.
And again, I go back to, if you're going to say it about Maduro, then why are we not saying it about the fentanyl coming out of China? You're going to go after Z. What about Putin killing people and the Ukraine? It all falls apart, Joe. I mean, it's so obviously bogus. And what I continue to struggle with is, who in this country supports this? I mean, because even in the somewhat limited defense of sort of the MAGA ideals, and where I think Marjorie Taylor Greene was correct, is that this isn't helping this country. This isn't about putting Americans first. This is something completely different.
I remember a piece written a couple of weeks ago about how a bunch of Trump voters now view the bombing of these small ships in the Caribbean, where we said were drug runners, and without due process, et cetera. I mean, the discussion that was going on then, and most, two of them were veterans, and they were a little concerned about the military being involved in the police action. They were kind of thoughtful about it, but the rest of them, and they were from around the country, and they were typical mega voters. They just said, I'm not losing sleep over some drug-running Venezuelans getting wiped out. That doesn't affect me. I have no concerns about that. And I think that is a glimpse of what's going on.
We'll be right back.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion at 10:33 on this Wednesday morning. And we'll continue with some letters and then move on to other topics. Robert writes, impeachment and removal is a political, social, and moral necessity. Let us hope common sense and wisdom do prevail. We'll get into that story in just a moment. Then we go to Micah. Polls show that most Americans know that there is something terribly wrong with this president. We need to get past just discussing that regarding Venezuela, he has no strategy, or that Venezuela and Greenland are intended distractions. This president doesn't do strategy. He just shoots to prove his power, his dominance over individuals, over the world. Last January, he shot domestically. This January, he shoots internationally. The question I want answered is how we get him and his sycophant vice president removed from office under the laws of our country.
Well, bringing up the question, what happens if the House does go Democrat?
That's right. Yeah. Bringing up that question, indeed.
But there's still not going to be enough votes in the Senate. I don't, we had an offline conversation earlier. I think impeachment should start with the cabinet members. I think Bondi's failure to follow the law on the Epstein files should be, if Congress flips, should be front and center. I think the use of the military to attacking the small boats that Hezgeth and others that have been appointed in the administration should face impeachment. That's where I really think impeachment should start.
President Donald Trump yesterday warned that Democrats would, quote, find a reason to impeach me, unquote, if the GOP lost control of Congress, using the prediction to pressure lawmakers to unify behind a narrow set of electoral priorities to win the 2026 midterm elections. This from the Washington Post. You got to win the midterms, because if we don't win the midterms, they'll find a reason to impeach me, Trump said. I'll get impeached. The remark was a rare acknowledgement of Trump's political vulnerability as Republicans prepared to face a Democratic Party that has a string of off-year election victories, favorable polling, and voter anxiety over an economy now fully under Trump's stewardship. The warning framed the midterms not only as a referendum on his agenda, but as a test of his overall legacy. Trump addressed the representatives at the start of an all-day policy forum for House Republicans inside the Kennedy Center, a performing arts building recently renamed in Trump's honor. The setting in the heart of Washington underscored how far Trump has come since January 6, 2021, exactly 5 years ago, when rioters stormed the Capitol and set off years of criminal prosecution and political isolation. In an address meant to energize his party, Trump conceded that his agenda has struggled to break through with voters. He complained that Americans had quickly moved past his record on illegal immigration and that the press had paid little attention to his push to pressure drug companies to cut prices, which has yielded wins, albeit limited, for consumers. He urged Republicans to focus their messaging on the following: drug prices, transgender athletes in women's sports, and cracking down on violent crime. That from the Washington Post.
Yeah, cracking down on political corruption would be great, too.
While you're at it.
Yeah.
Is that a... So that obviously comes from a place of concern and justifiable. But in the last few weeks, there has been this talk about the possibility of if there is a real change as a result of the midterm elections, that we could hear a renewed cry for impeachment.
We could. I hope the Democratic Party will stick with the messaging that has resonated with the voters in places like Virginia and Georgia and Iowa. It's about the economy. It's about affordability. It's about bread and butter. It's not necessarily about the infighting in D.C. And I think if they can stick with that message, a lot of these other issues, like the concern about the ICE raids, the concern about the fact that we've developed a paramilitary secret police force, I think that comes out. But I think if you're running on those issues, yeah, you're going to resonate with a certain population, but there's a much larger population that's concerned with the broader issues that's just a drag. I mean, the economy stinks, and this guy keeps telling us that the economy's great and he's done things.
He tells you Wall Street is great.
That's not the economy.
Right.
Yeah, but
right.
I mean, if anybody who's gone and bought any pharmaceuticals lately, the prices haven't come down. Mm. I mean, again, I don't know. I mean, this guy keeps whistling this tune, and it you know, when you go in to buy your groceries and you look at the bill doesn't lie.
You know, he'll say the price of eggs has come down, and they have.
And the price of gas, they're still super expensive, though. And
yeah.
this is it. But I think the Democrats, though, and this is a trap, though, Joe. On one hand, I'm buoyed by the fact that he's now concerned, because as I've looked at some of the polling, and I am very suspect of polling, I will admit, where things like the Latino vote is leaning right now, it's created some concerns in places like Texas, because some of these redistricting things, the redistricting gimmicks, were based on this idea that they were going to be able to hold on to the type of split ratios of voting that they saw in the presidential election. And it's a completely different world.
Mm.
So So, again, it's also he's got to gin up this fear. I mean, because he's got to figure out what the fear is. So if he's going to create fear about them, the illegal immigrant community, then he's going to admit that what he's doing is not working. So he's going to have to figure out who the villain's going to be, and it's going to be anybody who's left or center left, which is the majority of the country, which you got to be really careful of.
And the individual House members have to figure out their own villains of who they're going to blame for their own actions, right?
Well, I blame Johnson. I mean, it's kind of easy. I mean, he's the pinata that's getting ready to get whacked.
But to the voters, too? I mean, going out, when you go out to your district?
Yeah, the majority of the voters couldn't tell you who the speaker is.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That is the big problem. And you can call it apathy. You can call it... not a respect. I mean, one of the things that that MAGA has done is...
I wish I couldn't name Mike Johnson.
Who's that again?
Yeah, I wish I didn't know that, but go ahead.
No. I agree. And maybe it's apathy, but I think that the Trump administration and others have very successfully undermined the credibility of what we would call mainstream news, the conventional trustworthy news that we have known for decades in this country. And and now when someone hears, I mean, you know, take, for example, the Wall Street Journal, a trusted source among conservatives, publishes the picture and the story about Donald Trump's letter to Epstein, mm-hmm. that is a filthy little note, a ha-ha-ha note to him, signed by Donald Trump and a little drawing of the figure of a woman around it. And he says, that's not true. And then it comes out. It's in the Epstein files that get released. It was true. And, you know, but he told people it wasn't true. And that's good enough for people because now they, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Maybe somebody put it there. Oh, I don't know. Now, people don't know what to trust. And mm-hmm. I think that has worked to undermine what the real story is.
And you could extrapolate that to almost anything.
Yes,
you're absolutely right. But yeah. I mean, the number of wars that he has ended, the price of gas, the list goes on and on of those things he says over and over and over again that can sneak their way into actually popular public thought.
Yeah, silver lining, I guess, is that besides FIFA, nobody else is going to give him a Peace Prize.
I know you talked about this yesterday on the roundtable, but the Washington Post reported two different sources close to the president saying that if the woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize from Venezuela, who had the legitimate election overturned, had refused to accept it and cited Donald Trump as the true deserving person, she'd be president of Venezuela right now.
And I heard that story and I thought, well, okay, you know, that's, you know.
I know, it sounded.
That's a Bob Griffin snarky comment.
Yes, right.
And then as it went on, they were so, well, no, on two sources it said that's exactly the president had told them that point blank.
Well, he was talking in his speech, that unhinged speech about that he was copying his dance. Like, what are you? What?
Yeah, Maduro apparently is danced, and he's I don't know, he has a copyright, right? I don't know.
I think they call it the dementia shuffle. Is that what they call it?
Oh, Jesus. All right, let's take
that. Was apparently the last straw, right? Seeing him dance that way. But
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, finish up for this Wednesday morning. We welcome you. Last chance for your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll take a break right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. So we were talking
you
earlier.
Sound like the current administration.
there was a discussion earlier where we were talking about J.D. Vance and sort of where was J.D. Vance in all of this, and just as we were talking about that, a story popped up in the Washington Post that I thought was interesting, which is the question of that Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, being MIA on Venezuela and the operation there amid tensions over Trump policy.
The Post reporting President Donald Trump's top national security advisors in recent days have outdone one another, publicly extolling his bold decision to launch the risky military raid that captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. But one key figure has been largely absent from public view, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard. Gabbard, an Iraq War veteran who for years has spoken out against costly U.S. interventions abroad, waited more than 3 days before commenting publicly about Operation Absolute Resolve, her usually busy feeds on X, where she maintains official and personal accounts, were abnormally quiet until she issued a terse statement on Tuesday afternoon. That statement read, "President Trump promised the American people he would secure our borders, confront narco-terrorism, dangerous drug cartels, and drug traffickers. Kudos to our servicemen and women and intelligence operators for their flawless execution of the order to deliver on his promise through Operation Absolute Resolve." Gabbard's comments in support of the operation diverge sharply from the sentiments she expressed 7 years ago, explicitly warning against a Venezuelan intervention. Her 2019 social media posts have recirculated endlessly in the last few days, often accompanied by snarky comments. Bob? The U.S. needs to stay out of Venezuela, let the Venezuelan people determine their own future. We don't want other countries to choose our leaders, so we have to stop trying to choose theirs. Gabbard, then a Democratic congresswoman from Hawaii, posted that on X, then Twitter, in January of 2019.
What did you say about leaders, choosing leaders, Joe? It's actually looking pretty good right now.
There you go. Yeah.
Operation Absolute Resolve.
So, the thing to me is that this is, I understand there being tensions, and I understand not everyone in any administration is going to agree with everything. But
she's an opportunist. She was in trouble recently. What was that about? Does anybody remember? She said something, then there was pushback by Trump. Joe, do you remember?
I do. I remember the incident. I don't remember the details. But
neither I. But she's an opportunist. She wants to keep her job. So
but national security advisor. That's what gets me.
Yeah, but the problem is that all of these positions that used to mean something right now, they've become bit players. Okay, so
yes.
You know, what's Miller's title versus what his role is? Where's Homan versus Noam and DHS? I mean, all of these elements, Joe, that you can't tell who's doing what anymore. Mm-hmm. And she was pretty vocal. And actually, I didn't think some of her comments about Venezuela were far off that she made. And I think there's a lot of people that just figure it's better to go silent because this thing is gonna be too sticky. And I think that's where Vance is, honestly. I think Vance is reading the tea leaves for the election. And he's like, you know, I need to stay on the good side of these crazy people, but I'll sit over here and just
be quiet. Is somebody who can very easily flip positions, and he's a chameleon, a political chameleon, and he's demonstrated that time and again. And
he's a moral jellyfish.
Yeah, moral jellyfish. No, that's a really good way to say that. Yeah, I mean, there's people who are just going to put their wet finger in the air and just turn towards the way the wind is blowing and switch when the wind changes and
we could call it a hillbilly elegy.
You could. Yes, that's right. Not the best book.
You could, but, you know, believe it or not, the hillbillies actually have some deep values. And you're right. I don't see any deep values in J.D. Vance. Think about the comments he made. If you're his child, you know, that he repudiated his own wife and children publicly. Yeah. How do you live with that?
She's not a native-born American.
No.
And the children are children of a non-native-born American.
Right.
And therefore, yeah. And then he criticizes immigrants, first generations, et cetera.
J- Judith writes to us and says the Project 2025 document is a good example of the flood the zone strategy. Very thick, very detailed, provocation on every page, and very hard to absorb. That's a good point. We go to CJ. Everything is going to be okay because Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer are displaying courageous leadership by feeling sad and upset about all of this.
I guess I get the cynicism in that comment, but you know, if Hakeem Jeffries does become the Speaker of the House of Representatives, you know, next year after the midterms, there's a lot of debate about how quickly they should do everything. And I think given what happened during the Biden administration, I think the lesson is they should do whatever they're going to do very quickly. Mm. You know, you can't waste time. Everything changes so rapidly that they're going to have to begin the process of the majority of the House of Representatives holding the executive branch accountable. And that just has not happened.
We talked about the story on Monday, but it was only a blip because it was breaking as we were on the air, and obviously Venezuela was the order of the day. But it is the Tim Walz story, and of ending his run in the state of Minnesota. And Governor Tim Walz said that his decision to end his bid for a third term as Minnesota's governor came down to this: facing a torrent of threats and taunts from the Trump administration over a fraud scandal that has plagued the state social services system, he concluded that abandoning his political campaign might shield his constituents from further harm. I don't think any governor in history has had to fight a war against the federal government every single day, Mr. Walz told reporters on Tuesday in his first lengthy remarks about his decision, announced on Monday, to quit the race. The announcement came a few weeks after the White House began portraying Mr. Walz, a former vice presidential candidate and member of Congress, as an avatar of Democratic misgovernance. In early December, federal agencies began threatening to cut funding for Minnesota programs in response to a sprawling criminal investigation into fraud in a COVID-19 program meant to feed children and other safety net programs overseen by the state. Federal prosecutors have asserted that as much as $9 billion might have been stolen. The White House simultaneously launched an immigration crackdown in Minnesota as the president railed against the state's Somali diaspora, noting that a majority of defendants charged in the fraud cases are of Somali origin.
You know, part of the story is, of course, the continued attacks on Walz by the administration. But it's also a reality that under his leadership, the fraud was allowed to happen, and it was allowed to happen for seemingly political reasons, to avoid alienating a growing voter population, and that is. It's upsetting because Minnesota has a really interesting experimental approach to to establishing a social safety net that works, but it works only when the people believe in it and they back it up. And so by making this mistake of allowing the fraud to happen, by the way, the fraud was committed by some 59 people, right? Of a group of tens of thousands of people of Somali backgrounds. It really is a few individuals, but because the administration allowed it to happen, a vulnerable group of people, the many other thousands of people of Somali background, are now being viciously attacked by the administration, and a system that could work really well for Minnesota and for the country at large is something that is more socially oriented, that provides more social benefits, is now being put into question. So I too am upset about what has happened in Minnesota. And I do think it's a big part of the reason why he has decided to step down.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but aren't there still a lot of questions about what it is actually supposed fraud versus not? That there's a lot of questions about some of the charges that I think that the situation is a lot murkier than we're stating.
But rhetorically, it's a very effective tool for
sure.
the Trump administration. In fact, the
TU... you stopped beating your dog today, right?
Right, right. I mean, the TU had a story today about how the Trump administration is withholding funds to five Democratic states, including funds for child, basically child welfare, to support families with children. And they're withholding it from five states. They're all Democratic states, California, Colorado, Illinois, Minnesota, and, of course, New York. And Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, has threatened to go to court. And I mean, the argument is that we've seen some corruption in Minnesota, and maybe we better look at it elsewhere because it's probably going on elsewhere. And where do they look? They only look five places,
right.
You know, because that's the only place it could happen. I mean, it is a rhetorical tool used to, quote unquote, justify horrible action that's going to hurt people.
We'll end there on this morning. And my thanks to our group, Dr. Karen Riedel, Bob Griffin, and Mike Spain. We'll continue after this short break.